We now take pleasure in presenting one of the greatest Christmas classics of all time, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. We are fortunate that serving in the Royal Navy with NATO here in Norfolk during 1958 and 1960 was a great-grandson of the author himself. He gathered together a group of his English friends to bring you, originally on Christmas Eve 1958, this presentation of his ancestor's great masterpiece. Taking part in this recorded performance are his wife, Audrey Dickens, Norrie and Penny Martin, Tom and Anne Riddard, and Peter Swain, with his two young daughters, Nicola and Gail, providing the children's voices. Charles Dickens prefaced his story with the following words, with which, since they are as applicable now as when he wrote them, we take pleasure in introducing this broadcast. I have endeavored in this ghostly little book to raise the ghost of an idea, which shall not put my readers out of humor with themselves, with each other, with the season, or with me. May it haunt their houses pleasantly, and no one wish to lay it. Their faithful friend and servant, Charles Dickens.
Dead to begin with. There's no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead? Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, his sole friend and sole mourner. And even Scrooge was not so dreadfully cut up by the sad event, but that he was an excellent man of business on the very day of the funeral and solemnized it with an undoubted bargain. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire. Secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. Nobody ever stopped him in the street to say with gladsome looks, "Sir, my dear Scrooge, how are you?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what it was o'clock. No man or woman ever once in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. But what did Scrooge care? It was the very thing he liked. Once upon a time, of all good days in the year on Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was cold, bleak, biting weather, foggy withal, and he could hear the people in the court outside go wheezing up and down, beating their hands upon their breasts and stamping their feet upon the pavement stones to warm them. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who, in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room, and so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore, the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, in which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed.
A merry Christmas, Uncle. God save you.
It was Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation he had of his approach. Bah! Humbug.
Christmas a humbug, Uncle? You don't mean that, I'm sure.
I do. Merry Christmas. What right have you to be merry? What reason have you to be merry? You're poor enough.
Come then. What right have you to be dismal? What reason have you to be morose? You're rich enough.
Bah! Humbug.
Don't be cross, Uncle.
What else can I be when I live in such a world of fools as this? Merry Christmas. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer?
If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart, he should.
Uncle!
Nephew, keep Christmas in your own way, and let me keep it in mine.
Keep it? But you don't keep it.
Let me leave it alone, then. Much good may it do you. Much good it has ever done you.
There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited, I dare say. Christmas among the rest. But I'm sure I've always thought of Christmas time when it has come round, apart from the veneration due to its name and origin, if anything belonging to it can be apart from that, as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. The only time I know of in the long calendar of the year, when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts freely, and to think of people below them as if they really were fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe it has done me good, and will do me good. And I say, God bless it.
You're quite a powerful speaker, sir. I wonder you don't go into Parliament.
Don't be angry, Uncle. Come, dine with us tomorrow.
Scrooge said he would see him. Yes, indeed, he did. He went the whole length of the expression and said that he would see him in that extremity first.
But why? Why?
Why did you get married?
Because I fell in love.
Because you fell in love. Good afternoon.
Nay, Uncle, but you never came to see me before that happened. Why give it as a reason for not coming now?
Good afternoon.
I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why cannot we be friends?
Good afternoon.
I am sorry with all my heart to find you so resolute. We have never had any quarrel to which I have been a party, but I have made the trial in homage to Christmas, and I'll keep my Christmas humour to the last. So, a merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon.
And a happy new year.
Good afternoon. His nephew left the room without an angry word notwithstanding, and stopped at the outer door to bestow the greetings of the season on the clerk, who, cold as he was warmer than Scrooge, for he returned them cordially. There's another fellow, muttered Scrooge, who overheard him. My clerk, with 15 shillings a week and a wife and family, talking about a Merry Christmas. I'll retire to Bedlam. This lunatic, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands and bowed to him.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years. He died 7 years ago, this very night.
We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner.
It certainly was, for they had been two kindred spirits. At the ominous word liberality, Scrooge frowned and shook his head and handed the credentials back.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute, who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comforts, sir.
Are there no prisons?
Plenty of prisons.
And the union workhouses, are they still in operation?
They are. Still, I wish I could say they were not.
The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigour, then?
Both very busy, sir.
Ah. I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course. I'm very glad to hear it.
Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude, a few of us are endeavouring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We chose this time because it is a time, of all others, when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?
Nothing.
Oh, you wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there. Many would rather die.
If they would rather die, they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, excuse me, I don't know that.
But you might know it.
It's not my business. It's enough for a man to understand his own business and not to interfere with other people's. Mine occupies me constantly. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentleman withdrew. Scrooge resumed his labours with an improved opinion of himself and in a more facetious temper than was usual with him. At length the hour of shutting up the counting-house arrived. You'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose.
If quite convenient, sir.
It's not convenient, and it's not fair. If I was to stop half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used, I'll be bound. If you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work?
It's only once a year, sir.
A poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th day of December. But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier next morning.
The clerk promised that he would, and Scrooge walked out with a growl. The office was closed in a twinkling, and the clerk, with the long ends of his comforter dangling below his waist, for he boasted no greatcoat, went down a slide on Cornhill at the end of a line of boys 20 times in honour of its being Christmas Eve, and then ran home to Camden Town as hard as he could pelt to play at blind man's buff. Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern, and having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, went home to his rooms. There he locked himself in, took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers and his nightcap, and sat down before the fire to take his gruel. As he sat in his chair, his glance happened to rest upon a bell, a disused bell that hung in his room for some purpose now forgotten, and now, to his great astonishment and dread, began to swing. It swung so softly in the outset that it scarcely made a sound, but soon it rang out loudly, and so did every bell in the house. The bells ceased as they had begun, together, but were succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain over the cases in the wine merchant's cellar. Scrooge then remembered to have heard that ghosts in haunted houses were described as dragging chains. "It's humbugs," said Scrooge. "I won't believe it." His colour changed, though, when without a pause it came up past the floors below, on up the stairs, and passed into the room before his eyes. Upon its coming up, the dying flame leaped up as though it cried, "I know him, Marley's ghost," and fell again. The same face, the very same. Marley in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights and boots, the tassels on the latter bristling like his pigtail and his coat skirts, and the hair upon his head. The chain was long and wound about him like a tail, and it was made, for Scrooge observed it closely, of cash boxes, keys, padlocks, ledgers, deeds, and heavy purses wrought in steel. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him, and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. "How now? What do you want with me?"
"Much."
Marley's voice. No doubt about it. "Who are you?"
"Ask me who I was."
"Who were you then? You're particular for a shade." He was going to say to a shade, but substituted this as more appropriate.
"In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley."
"Sit down," said Scrooge.
"You don't believe in me?"
"I don't."
"What evidence would you have of my reality beyond that of your senses?"
"I don't know."
"Why do you doubt your senses?"
Because a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheats. You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are. Humbug." At this, the spirit raised a frightful cry and shook its chain with such a dismal and appalling noise that Scrooge fell upon his knees and clasped his hands before his face. "Mercy, dreadful apparition, why do you trouble me?"
"Man of worldly mind, do you believe in me or not?"
"I do, I must. But why do spirits walk the earth, and why do they come to me?"
"It is required of every man that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men and travel far and wide. And if that spirit goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death. It is doomed to wander through the world, oh, woe is me, and witness what it cannot share, but might have shared on earth and turned to happiness."
Again the spirit raised a cry, and shook its chain and wrung its shadowy hand. "You are fettered. Tell me why."
"I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will I wore it. Is its pattern strange to you?"
Scrooge trembled more and more.
"Or would you know the weight and length of the strong coil you bear yourself? It was full as heavy and long as this, 7 Christmas Eves ago. You have labored on it since. It is a ponderous chain."
"Jacob, Jacob Marley, tell me more. Speak comfort to me, Jacob."
"I have none to give. It comes from other regions, Ebenezer Scrooge, and is conveyed by other ministers to other kinds of men. Nor can I tell you what I would. A very little more is all that is permitted to me. I cannot rest, I cannot stay, I cannot linger anywhere. My spirit never walked in life beyond our counting house. Mark me, in life my spirit never roved beyond the narrow limits of our own money-changing hole. And weary journeys lie before me."
But you were always a good man of business, Jacob.
Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. Charity, mercy, forbearance, and benevolence were all my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business.
Scrooge was very much dismayed to hear the spectre going on at this rate, and began to quake exceedingly.
Hear me, my time is nearly gone.
I will, but don't be hard upon me. Don't be flowery, Jacob.
I am here tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate. A chance and hope of my procuring, Ebenezer.
You were always a good friend to me, thank you.
You will be haunted by three spirits.
Is that the chance and hope you mentioned, Jacob?
It is.
I think I'd rather not.
Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tomorrow when the bell tolls one.
Couldn't I take them all at once and have it over, Jacob?
Expect the second on the next night at the same hour. The third upon the next night when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate. Look to see me no more. And look that, for your own sake, you remember what has passed between us.
When it had said these words, the spectre floated on out upon the bleak, dark night. Scrooge followed to the window, desperate in his curiosity, and looked out. He closed the window and examined the door by which the ghost had entered. It was double-locked, as he had locked it with his own hands, and the bolts were undisturbed. He tried to say hum, but stopped at the first syllable. And being from the emotion he had undergone, or the fatigues of the day, or his glimpse of the invisible world, or the dull conversation of the ghost, or the lateness of the hour, much in need of repose, went straight to bed without undressing, and fell asleep upon the instant. When Scrooge awoke, it was so dark that looking out of bed, he could scarcely distinguish the transparent window from the opaque walls of his chamber. He was endeavoring to pierce the darkness with his ferret eyes when the chimes of a neighboring clock struck the four quarters. So he listened for the hour. To his great astonishment, the heavy bell went from 6 to 7, and 7 to 8, and regularly up to 12, then stopped. 12? It was past 2 when he went to bed. The clock was wrong. An icicle must have got into the works. 12. Scrooge thought and thought, and thought it over and over and over, and could make nothing of it. The more he thought, the more he endeavored not to think, and the more he endeavored not to think, the more he thought. At length the clock chimed again. The hour itself, said Scrooge triumphantly, and nothing else. He spoke before the hour bell sounded, which it now did with a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy whum. Light flashed up in his room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, I tell you, by a hand. Not the curtains at his feet, nor the curtains at his back, but those to which his face was addressed. The curtains of his bed were drawn aside, and Scrooge, starting up into a half-recumbent attitude, found himself face to face with the unearthly visitor who drew them, as close to it as I am now to you and am standing in the spirit at your elbow. It was a strange figure, like a child, yet not so much like a child as like an old man viewed through some supernatural medium which gave him the appearance of having receded from the view and being diminished to a child's proportions. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on its skin. Are you the spirit, sir, whose coming was foretold to me?
I am.
Who and what are you?
I am the ghost of Christmas past.
Long past?
No, your past. Rise and walk with me.
It would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted for pedestrian purposes, that bed was warm and the thermometer a long way below freezing, that he was clad but lightly in his slippers, dressing gown and nightcap, and that he had a cold upon him at the time. The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit made towards the window, clasped its robe in supplication. I am mortal and liable to fall.
Bear but a touch of my hand, and you shall be upheld in more than this.
As the words were spoken, they passed through the wall and stood upon an open country road with fields on either hand. The city had entirely vanished. Not a vestige of it was to be seen. The darkness and the mist had vanished with it, for it was a clear, cold winter day with snow upon the ground. Good heavens! I was bred in this place. I was a boy here.
He was conscious of a thousand odors floating in the air, each one connected with a thousand thoughts and hopes and joys and cares, long, long forgotten.
Your lip is trembling, and what is that upon your cheek?
Scrooge muttered with an unusual catching in his voice that it's a pimple, and begged the ghost to lead him where he would.
You recollect the way?
Remember it? I could walk it blindfold.
Strange to have forgotten it for so many years. Let us go on.
They walked along the road, Scrooge recognizing every gate and post and tree, until a little market town appeared in the distance, with its bridge, its church, and winding river.
The school is not quite deserted. A solitary child, neglected by his friends, is left there still.
Scrooge said he knew it, and he sobbed. They went, the ghost and Scrooge, across the hall to a door at the back of the house. It opened before them and disclosed a long, bare, melancholy room, made barer still by lines of plain deal forms and desks. At one of these, a lonely boy was reading near a feeble fire, and Scrooge sat down upon a form and wept to see his poor, forgotten self as he had used to be. The spirit touched him on the arm and pointed to his younger self, intent upon his reading. "Poor boy," said Scrooge in a manner very foreign to his usual character. And then again, in pity for his former self, "Poor boy," he cried. "I wish... but it's too late now."
"What's the matter?"
"Nothing, nothing. There was a boy singing a Christmas carol at my door last night. I should like to have given him something, that's all." The ghost smiled thoughtfully and waved his hand.
"Let us see another Christmas."
Although they had but that moment left the school behind them, they were now in the busy thoroughfare of a city. It was made plain enough by the dressing of the shops that here, too, it was Christmas time again. But it was evening, and the streets were lighted up. The ghost stopped at a certain warehouse door and asked Scrooge if he knew it. "Know it? I was apprenticed here." They went in. At the sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig sitting behind such a high desk that if he had been 2 inches taller, he must have knocked his head against the ceiling, Scrooge cried in great excitement, "Why, it's old Fezziwig! Bless his heart, it's Fezziwig alive again!" Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and looked up at the clock, which pointed to the hour of 7. He rubbed his hands, adjusted his capacious waistcoat, laughed all over himself from his shoes to his organ of benevolence, and called out in a comfortable, oily, rich, fat, jovial voice,
"Yo-ho there, Ebenezer, Dick!"
Scrooge's former self, now grown a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow prentice. "Dick Wilkins, to be sure. Bless me, yes, there he is. He was very much attached to me, was Dick. Poor Dick. Dear, dear."
"Yo-ho, my boys. No more work tonight. Christmas Eve, Dick. Christmas, Ebenezer. Let's have the shutters up before a man can say Jack Robinson."
You wouldn't believe how those two fellows went at it. They charged into the street with the shutters, 1, 2, 3, had them in their places, 4, 5, 6, barred them and pinned them, 7, 8, 9, and came back before you could have got to 12, panting like racehorses.
"Hiley ho! Clear away, me lads, and let's have lots of room here. Hiley ho, Dick! Cheer up, Ebenezer!"
Clear away? There was nothing they couldn't have cleared away, or wouldn't have cleared away with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. Then in came a fiddler with a music book, and went up to the lofted desk and made an orchestra of it, and tuned like 50 stomach aches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came the 3 Mrs. Fezziwig, beaming and lovable. In came the 6 young followers whose hearts they broke. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. Away they all went, 20 couple at once, hands half round and back again the other way, down the middle and up again, round and round, in various stages of affectionate grouping. Old top couple always turning up in the wrong place, new top couple starting off again as soon as they got there, all top couples at once, and not a bottom one to help them. There were more dances, and there were forfeits. And more dances, and there was cake, and there was negus. And there was a great piece of cold roast, and there was a great piece of cold boiled, and there were mince pies, and plenty of beer. But the great effect of the evening came after the roast and boiled, when the fiddler, an artful dog mind, the sort of man who knew his business better than you or I could have told it him, struck up Sir Roger de Coverley. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig. Top couple, too, with a good stiff bit of work cut out for them. 3 or 4 and 20 pair of partners, people who would not be trifled with. People who would dance and had no notion of walking. When the clock struck 11, this domestic ball broke up. Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations one on either side of the door,
and shaking hands with every person individually as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas.
A small matter to make these silly folks so full of gratitude.
Small?
Why is it not? He has spent but a few pounds of your mortal money, 3 or 4 perhaps. Is that so much that he deserves this praise?
It isn't that. It isn't that, Spirit. He has the power to render us happy or unhappy, to make our service light or burdensome, a pleasure or a toil. Say that his power lies in words and looks, in things so slight and insignificant that it is impossible to add and count them up. What then? The happiness he gives is quite as great as if it cost a fortune. He felt the Spirit's glance and stopped.
What's the matter?
Nothing particular.
Something, I think.
No, I should just like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk just now, that's all.
My time grows short. Quick!
This was not addressed to Scrooge or to anyone whom he could see, but it produced an immediate effect. For again Scrooge saw himself. He was older now, a man in the prime of life. His face had not the harsh and rigid lines of later years, but it had begun to wear the signs of care and avarice. There was an eager, greedy, restless motion in the eye, which showed the passion that had taken root and where the shadow of the growing tree would fall. He was not alone, but sat by the side of a fair young girl in mourning dress, in whose eyes there were tears which sparkled in the light that shone out of the ghost of Christmas past.
It matters little, to you very little. Another idol has displaced me, and if it can cheer and comfort in time to come, as I would have tried to do, I have no just cause to grieve.
What idol has displaced you?
A golden one.
This is the even-handed dealing of the world. There is nothing on which it is so hard as poverty.
If you were free, today, tomorrow, yesterday, can even I believe that you would choose a dowerless girl, you who in your very confidence with her weigh everything by gain? Or, choosing her, if for a moment you were false enough to your one guiding principle to do so, do I not know that your repentance and regret would surely follow? I do. And I release you, with a full heart, for the love of him you once were.
Oh, Spirit, remove me from this place.
I told you these were the shadows of the things that have been. That they are what they are, do not blame me.
Remove me. I cannot bear it. He turned upon the ghost, and seeing that it looked upon him with a face in which, in some strange way, there were fragments of all the faces it had shown him, wrestled with it. Leave me, take me back, haunt me no longer. He was conscious of being exhausted and overcome by an irresistible drowsiness, and further of being back in his own bedroom. He had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep. Awaking in the middle of a prodigiously tough snore and sitting up in bed to get his thoughts together, Scrooge had no occasion to be told that the bell was again upon the stroke of one. Now, being prepared for almost anything, he was by no means prepared for nothing. And consequently, when the bell struck one and no shape appeared, he was taken with a violent fit of trembling. All this time, he lay upon his bed, the core and center of a blaze of ruddy light, which streamed upon it when the clock proclaimed the hour, and which, being only light, was more alarming than a dozen ghosts, as he was powerless to make out what it meant or would be at. At last he began to think that the source and secret of this ghostly light might be in the adjoining room, from whence, on tracing it, it seemed to shine. This idea taking full possession of his mind, he got up softly and shuffled in his slippers to the door. It was his own room. There was no doubt about that. But it had undergone a surprising transformation. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove, from every part of which bright, gleaming berries glistened. The crisp leaves of holly, mistletoe, and ivy reflected back the light as if so many little mirrors had been scattered there, and such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that dull petrification of a hearth had never known in Scrooge's time or Marley's, or for many and many a winter season gone. Heaped up on the floor to form a kind of throne were turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, long wreaths of sausages, mince pies, plum puddings, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, cherry-cheeked apples, juicy oranges, luscious pears, immense 12th cakes, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon this couch there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch, in shape not unlike Plenty's horn, and held it up, high up, to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door.
Come in, and know me better, man.
Scrooge entered timidly and hung his head before this spirit. He was not the dogged Scrooge he had been, and though the spirit's eyes were clear and kind, he did not like to meet them.
I am the ghost of Christmas present. Look upon me. You've never seen the like of me before?
Never.
Have never walked forth with the younger members of my family? Meaning, for I am very young, my older brothers born in these later years?
I don't think I have. I'm afraid I have not. Have you had many brothers, Spirit?
More than 1,800.
A tremendous family to provide for. The ghost of Christmas present rose. Spirit, conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion, and I learned a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it.
Touch my robe.
Scrooge did as he was told and held it fast. Holly, mistletoe, red berries, ivy, turkeys, geese, game, poultry, brawn, meat, pigs, sausages, oysters, pies, puddings, fruit and punch. All vanished instantly. So did the room, the fire, the ruddy glow, the hour of night. And they stood in the city streets on Christmas morning, where, for the weather was severe, the people made a rough but brisk and not unpleasant kind of music in scraping the snow from the pavement in front of their dwellings, and from the tops of their houses, whence it was mad delight to the boys to see it come pumping down into the road below and splitting into little snowstorms. The poulterers' shops were still half open, and the fruiterers were radiant in their glory. But the grocers, oh, the grocers, nearly closed with perhaps two shutters down or one, but through those gaps such glimpses. It was not alone that the scales descending on the counter made a merry sound, or that the twine and roller parted company so briskly, or that the canisters were rattled up and down like juggling tricks, or even that the blended scents of tea and coffee were so grateful to the nose, or even that the raisins were so plentiful and rare, the almonds so extremely white, the sticks of cinnamon so long and straight, the other spices so delicious, the candied fruits so caked and spotted with molten sugar as to make the coldest lookers-on feel faint and subsequently bilious. But the customers were all so hurried and so eager in the hopeful promise of the day that they tumbled up against each other at the door, crashing their baskets wildly, and left their purchases upon the counter and came running back to fetch them, and committed hundreds of the like mistakes in the best humour possible. But soon the steeples called good people all to church and chapel, and away they came, flocking through the streets in their best clothes and with their gayest faces. And at the same time there emerged from scores of by-streets, lanes and turnings innumerable people, carrying their dinners to the bakers' shops. The sight of these poor revellers appeared to interest the spirit very much, for he stood with Scrooge beside him in a baker's doorway, and taking off the covers as their bearers passed, sprinkled incense on their dinners from his torch. And it was a very uncommon kind of torch, for once or twice, when there were angry words between some dinner carriers who had jostled each other, he shed a few drops of water on them from it, and their good humour was restored directly. For, they said, it was a shame to quarrel upon Christmas Day. And so it was. God love it, so it was. And perhaps it was the pleasure the good spirit had in showing off this power of his, or else it was his own kind, generous nature and his sympathy with all poor men, that led him straight to Scrooge's clerk's. For there he went and took Scrooge with him, holding to his robe. And on the threshold of the door the spirit smiled and stopped to bless Bob Cratchit's dwelling with the sprinklings of his torch. Then up rose Mrs. Cratchit, Cratchit's wife, dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, but brave in ribbons which are cheap and make a goodly show for sixpence. And she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, second of her daughters, also brave in ribbons, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes, and getting the corners of his monstrous shirt collar, Bob's private property conferred upon his son and heir in honour of the day, into his mouth, rejoiced to find himself so gallantly attired, and yearned to show his linen in the fashionable parks. And now two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelled the goose and known it for their own, and basking in luxurious thoughts of sage and onion. These young Cratchits danced about the table and exalted Master Peter Cratchit to the skies, while he, not proud, although his collars nearly choked him, blew the fire until the slow potatoes bubbling up knocked loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled.
Whatever has got your precious father then, and your brother Tiny Tim? And Martha weren't as late last Christmas Day by half an hour.
Here's Martha, Mother.
Here's Martha, Mother. Hurrah! There's such a goose, Martha.
Why, bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are.
We'd a deal of work to finish up last night and had to clear away this morning, Mother.
Well, never mind so long as you're come. Sit ye down before the fire, my dear, and have a warm, Lord bless you.
There's Father coming.
Then in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter, exclusive of the fringe, hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned and brushed to look seasonable, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas for Tiny Tim. He bore a little crutch, and had his limbs supported by an iron frame. The two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim and bore him off into the wash-house that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper.
And how did little Tim behave?
As good as gold and better. Somehow he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much and thinks the strangest things you ever heard. He told me coming home that he hoped the people saw him in the church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember on Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see.
But soon a bustle ensued that you might have thought a goose the rarest of all birds, a feathered phenomenon to which a black swan was a matter of course. And indeed, in truth, it was something very like it in that house. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, ready beforehand in a little saucepan, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigour. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounted guard upon their posts, crammed spoons into their mouths, lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there was ever such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavour, size and cheapness were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said with great delight, surveying one small atom of a bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all at last. Yet everyone had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it in. Oh, a wonderful pudding. Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that now the weight was off her mind, she would confess that she'd had her doubts about the quantity of flour. Everybody had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. It would have been flat heresy to do so. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing. At length, the dinner was all done. The cloth was cleared, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. Then Bob served out the hot stuff from the jug with beaming looks, while the chestnuts on the fire sputtered and cracked noisily.
I'll give you a toast, my dears. A Merry Christmas to us all. God bless us.
A Merry Christmas to us all. God bless us, everyone.
Spirit, tell me if Tiny Tim will live.
I see a vacant seat in the poor chimney corner, and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved.
Oh, no, no, kind spirit. Say he will be spared.
If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, none other of my race will find him here. What then? If he be like to die, he had better do so and decrease the surplus population.
Scrooge bent before the ghost's rebuke, and trembling cast his eyes upon the ground. But he raised them speedily on hearing his own name.
Mr. Scrooge? Mr. Scrooge, I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast.
The founder of the feast, indeed. I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I hope he'd have a good appetite for it.
My dear, the children. Christmas Day.
It should be Christmas Day, I'm sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow.
My dear, Christmas Day.
I'll drink his health for your sake and the day's, not for his. Long life to him. A Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt.
The children drank the toast after her. It was the first of their proceedings which had no heartiness about it. Tiny Tim drank it last of all, but he didn't care tuppence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for full 5 minutes. The spirit didn't tarry here, but bade Scrooge hold his robe, and on they sped. They visited many other places, and everyone they saw, waking or sleeping, good or bad, had had a kinder word for another on that day than on any day in the year, and had shared to some extent in its festivities. It was a great surprise to Scrooge, while thus engaged, to hear a hearty laugh. It was a much greater surprise to recognize it as his own nephew's, and to find himself in a bright, dry, gleaming room with the spirit standing smiling by his side and looking at that same nephew with approving affability.
He said that Christmas was a humbug, as I live. He believed it, too.
Poor shame for him, Fred. I have no patience with him.
Oh, I have. I'm sorry for him. I couldn't be angry with him if I tried. Who suffers by his ill whims? Himself, always. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us. What's the consequence? He don't lose much of a dinner.
Indeed, I think he loses a very good dinner.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm very glad to hear it, because I haven't any great faith in these young housekeepers. What do you say, Topper?
Topper had clearly got his eye upon one of Scrooge's niece's sisters, for he answered that a bachelor was a wretched outcast who had no right to express an opinion on the subject. Whereat Scrooge's niece's sister, the plump one with the lace tucker, not the one with the roses, blushed. After tea, they had some music, and after the music, they played at forfeits. For it is good to be children sometimes, and never better than at Christmas, when its mighty founder was a child himself. Stop. There was first a game of blind man's buff. Of course there was. And I no more believe Topper was really blind than I believe he had eyes in his boots. My opinion is that it was a done thing between him and Scrooge's nephew, and that the ghost of Christmas present knew it. The way he went after that plump sister in the lace tucker was an outrage on the credulity of human nature. Knocking down the fire irons, tumbling over the chairs, bumping up against the piano, smothering himself amongst the curtains. Wherever she went, there went he. He always knew where the plump sister was. He wouldn't catch anybody else. If you had fallen up against him on purpose, as some of them did, he would have made a feint of endeavouring to seize you, which would have been an affront to your understanding, and would instantly have sidled off in the direction of the plump sister. She often cried out that it wasn't fair, and really it was not. No doubt she told him her opinion of it when, another blind man being in office, they were so very confidential together behind the curtains. Scrooge was regarding the party with such a benevolent eye that when the spirit told him that they must depart, he begged like a boy to be allowed to stay until the guests had gone.
You must depart. My life upon this globe is very brief. It ends tonight.
Tonight?
Tonight at midnight. Hark, the time is drawing near.
Forgive me if I'm not justified in what I ask, but I see something strange and not belonging to yourself protruding from your skirts. Is it a foot or a claw?
It might be a claw, but the flesh there is upon it. Look here.
From the folding of its robe, it brought two children. Wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They kneeled down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment.
And look here, look down here.
They were a boy and a girl. Yellow, meagre, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate too in their humility. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade through all the mysteries of wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible and dread. Spirits, are they yours?
They are men. And they cling to me appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree. But most of all, beware this boy. For on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing is erased. Deny it. Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your factious purposes and make it worse. And bide the end.
Have they no refuge or resource?
Are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses?
Scrooge, recognizing his own words, could say nothing, but he hung his head. The bell struck 12. Scrooge looked about him for the ghost and saw it not. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, he remembered the prediction of old Jacob Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground towards him. It was shrouded in a deep black garment which concealed its head, its face, its form, and left nothing of it visible save one outstretched hand. But for this it would have been difficult to detach its figure from the night and separate it from the darkness by which it was surrounded. I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come. The spirit answered not, but pointed onwards with its hand. You are about to show me shadows of the things that have not happened, but will happen in the time before us. Is that so, spirit? The upper portion of the garment was contracted for an instant in its folds, as if the spirit had inclined its head. That was the only answer he received. Although well used to ghostly company by this time, Scrooge feared this island shape so much that his legs trembled beneath him, and he found that he could hardly stand when he prepared to follow it. The spirit paused a moment, as observing his condition and giving him time to recover. Oh, ghost of the future, I fear you more than any spectre I have seen. But as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to be another man from what I was, I am prepared to bear you company, and do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me? It gave him no reply. The hand was pointed straight before them. Lead on, lead on. The night is waning fast, and it is precious time to me, I know. Lead on, spirit. They scarcely seemed to enter the city, for the city rather seemed to spring up about them and encompass them of its own act. But there they were, in the heart of it, on change, amongst the merchants, who hurried up and down and chinked the money in their pockets and conversed in groups, and looked at their watches and trifled thoughtfully with their great gold seals, and so forth, as Scrooge had seen them often. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of businessmen. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk.
No, I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead.
When did he die?
Last night, I believe.
Why, what was the matter with him? I thought he'd never die.
Oh, Mose.
What's he done with his money?
I haven't heard. Left it to his company, perhaps. He hasn't left it to me, that's all I know.
Well, seasonable weather for Christmas time. You're not a skater, I suppose.
No. Something else to think of. Well, good morning.
Not another word. That was their meeting, their conversation, and their parting. They left the busy scene and went into an obscure part of the town where Scrooge had never penetrated before, although he recognized its situation and its bad repute. The ways were foul and narrow, the shops and houses wretched, the people half naked, drunken, slipshod, ugly. Alleys and archways, like so many cesspools, disgorged their offences of smell and dirt and life upon the straggling streets, and the whole quarter reeked with crime, with filth and misery. Far in this den of infamous resort, there was a low-browed beetling shop below a penthouse roof, where iron, old rags, bottles, bones, and greasy offal were bought. Sitting in among the wares he dealt in by a charcoal stove, made of old bricks, was a grey-haired rascal nearly 70 years of age. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop, but she had scarcely entered when another woman similarly laden came in too, and she was closely followed by a man in faded black who was no less startled by the sight of them than they had been upon the recognition of each other. After a short period of blank astonishment in which the old man with the pipe had joined them, they all three burst into a laugh.
Let the charwoman alone to be the first, let the laundress alone to be the second, and let the undertaker's man alone to be the third. Look here, old Joe, here's a chance. If we haven't all three met here without meaning it.
What odds, Mrs. Dilber, what odds then? Every person has a right to take care of themselves. He always did.
That's true indeed, no man more so.
Well then don't stand staring as if you was a fried woman who's the wiser. We're not going to pick holes in each other's coats, I suppose.
No, indeed, I should hope not.
Very well, then, that's enough. Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose?
No, indeed.
If he wanted to keep him after he was dead, a wicked old screw, why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death. Instead of lying gasping out his last there all alone by himself.
It's the truest word that ever was spoke. It's a judgment on him.
I wish it was a little heavier judgment, and it should have been, you may depend on it, if I could have laid my hands on anything else. Open that bundle, old Joe, and let me know the value of it.
But the gallantry of her friends would not allow this, and the man in faded black, mounting the breech first, produced his plunder. It was not extensive. A seal or two, a pencil case, a pair of sleeve buttons, and a brooch of no great value were all. They were severally examined and appraised by old Joe, who chalked the sums he was disposed to give for each upon the wall, and added them up into a total when he found that there was nothing more to come. Mrs. Dilber was next. Sheets and towels, a little wearing apparel, two old-fashioned silver teaspoons, a pair of sugar tongs, and a few boots. Her account was stated on the wall in the same manner.
I always gives too much to ladies. It's a weakness of mine. That's the way I ruin myself. That's your account. If you asked me for another penny and made it an open question, I'd repent of being so liberal and knock off half a crown.
And now undo my bundle, Joe.
Joe went down on his knees for the greater convenience of opening it, and having unfastened a great many knots, dragged out a large and heavy roll of some dark stuff.
What do you call this? Bed curtains?
Ah, bed curtains.
You don't mean to say you took him down rings and all with him lying there?
Yes, I do. Why not?
You were born to make your fortune, and you'll certainly do it.
I certainly shan't hold my hand when I can get anything by reaching it out for the sake of such a man as he was. I promise you, Joe. Don't drop that oil upon the blankets now.
His blankets?
Whose else's do you think? He isn't likely to take cold without them, I dare say.
I hope he didn't die of anything catching, eh?
Don't you be afraid of that. I ain't so fond of his company that I'd loiter about him for such things if he did.
Scrooge listened to their dialogue in horror. As they sat grouped about their spoil in the scanty light afforded by the old man's lamp, he viewed them with a detestation and disgust which could hardly have been greater, though they had been obscene demons marketing the corpse itself. Spirit, said Scrooge, shuddering from head to foot, I see. The case of this unhappy man might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heavens, what is that? He recoiled in terror, for the scene had changed, and now he almost touched a bed, a bare, uncurtained bed, on which, beneath a ragged sheet, there lay a something covered up, which, though it was dumb, announced itself in awful language. It lay in the dark, empty house, with not a man, a woman, or a child to say, he was kind to me in this or that, and for the memory of one kind word, I will be kind to him. A cat was tearing at the door, and there was a sound of gnawing rats beneath the hearthstone. What they wanted in the room of death, and why they were so restless and disturbed, Scrooge did not dare to think. Oh, spirit, this is a fearful place. In leaving it, I shall not leave its lesson, trust me. Let us go on. Let me see some tenderness connected with the death, or that dark chamber spirit will be forever present to me. The ghost conducted him through several streets familiar to his feet. And as they went along, Scrooge looked here and there to find himself, but nowhere was he to be seen. They entered poor Bob Cratchit's house, the dwelling he had visited before, and found the mother and the children seated round the fire. Quiet. Very quiet. The noisy little Cratchits were as still as statues in one corner, and sat looking up at Peter, who had a book before him. The mother and her daughters were engaged in sewing, but surely they were very quiet.
And he took a child and set him in the midst of them.
I can sew no longer. The colour hurts my eyes.
The colour? Ah, poor Tiny Tim.
They're better now again. It makes them weak by candlelight. And I wouldn't show weak eyes to your father when he comes home for all the world. It must be near his time.
Past it, rather. But I think he's walked a little slower than he used to these last few evenings, Mother.
I've known him walk with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder very fast indeed.
And so have I, often.
And so have I.
But he was very light to carry, and his father loved him so that it was no trouble. No trouble. And there is your father at the door.
She hurried out to meet him. And little Bob in his comforter, he had need of it, poor fellow, came in. His tea was ready on the hob, and they all tried who should help him to it most. Then the two young Cratchits got upon his knees and laid each child a little cheek against his face, as if they said, "Don't mind it, father. Don't be grieved." Bob was very cheerful with them and spoke pleasantly to all the family. He looked at the work upon the table and praised the industry and speed of Mrs. Cratchit and the girls. They would be done long before Sunday, he said.
Sunday? You went today, then, Robert?
Yes, my dear. I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. But you'll see it often. I promised him that I would walk there on Sunday. My little, little child. My little child.
He broke down all at once. He couldn't help it. If he could have helped it, he and his child would have been further apart, perhaps, than they were. They drew about the fire and talked, the girls and their mother working still,
Bob told them of the extraordinary kindness of Mr. Scrooge's nephew, whom he had scarcely seen but once, but who had asked if there was any service he could be to them.
Now, it wasn't for the sake of anything he might be able to do for us, so much as for his kind way, that this was quite delightful. It really seemed as if he had known our Tiny Tim and felt with us.
I'm sure he is a good soul.
You would be surer of it, my dear, if you saw him and spoke to him. I shouldn't be at all surprised, mark what I say, if he got Peter a better situation.
Only hear that, Peter.
And then Peter will be keeping company with someone and setting up for himself.
Get along with you.
It's just as likely as not one of these days, though there's plenty of time for that, my dear. But however and whenever we part from one another, I'm sure we shall none of us forget poor Tiny Tim, shall we? Or this first parting that there was among us?
Never, Father.
And I know, my dears, that when we recollect how patient and how mild he was, although he was a little child, we shall not quarrel easily among ourselves and forget poor Tiny Tim in doing it.
Oh, no, never, Father.
I am very happy. I'm very happy.
Mrs. Cratchit kissed him. His daughters kissed him. The two young Cratchits kissed him. And Peter and himself shook hands. Spirit of Tiny Tim, thy childish essence was from God. Spectre, said Scrooge, something informs me that our parting moment is at hand. I know it, but I know not how. Tell me what man that was whom we saw lying dead. The ghost of Christmas yet to come conveyed him as before, though at a different time, he thought. Indeed, there seemed no order in these latter visions, save that they were in the future, into the resorts of businessmen, but showed him not himself. Indeed, the spirit did not stay for anything, but went straight on, as to the end just now desired. The churchyard. Here, then, the wretched man whose name he had now to learn lay underneath the ground. It was a worthy place, walled in by houses, overrun by grass and weeds, the growth of vegetation's death, not life, choked up with too much burying, fat with repleted appetite, a worthy place. The spirit stood among the graves and pointed down to one. He advanced towards it, trembling. The phantom was exactly as it had been, but he dreaded that he saw a new meaning in its solemn shape. Before I draw nearer to that stone to which you point, answer me one question. Are these the shadows of the things that will be, or are they the shadow of the things that may be only? Still the ghost pointed downwards to the grave by which it stood. Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if persevered in, they must lead. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me. The spirit was as immovable as ever. Scrooge crept towards it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read upon the stone of the neglected grave his own name, Ebenezer Scrooge. Am I that man who lay upon the bed? The finger pointed from the grave to him and back again. Oh, no, spirit, no. The finger still was there. Spirit, hear me. I'm not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been but for this intercourse. Why do you show me this if I'm past all hope? For the first time, the hand appeared to shake. Good spirit, your nature intercedes for me and pities me. Assure me that I may yet change these shadows you have shown me by an altered life. The kind hand trembled. I will honor Christmas in my heart and try and keep it all the year. I will live in the past, the present, and the future. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. I will not shut out the lessons that they teach. Oh, tell me I may sponge away the writing on this stone. In his agony, he caught the spectral hand. It sought to free itself, but he was strong in his entreaty and detained it. The spirit, stronger yet, repulsed him. Holding up his hands in a last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrank, collapsed, and dwindled down to a bedpost. Yes, and the bedpost was his own. The bed was his own, the room was his own. Best and happiest of all, the time before him was his own to make amends in. I will live in the past, the present, and the future, Scrooge repeated as he scrambled out of bed. The spirits of all three shall strive within me. Oh, Jacob Marley, heaven and the Christmas time be praised for this. I say it on my knees, old Jacob, on my knees.
He was so flustered and so glaying with his good intentions that his broken voice could scarcely answer to his call. He had been sobbing violently in his conflict with the spirit, and his face was wet with tears. "They are not torn down," cried Scrooge, folding one of his bed curtains in his arms. "They are not torn down, rings and all. They are here. I am here. The shadows of the things that would have been may be dispelled. They will be. I know they will be. I don't know what day of the month it is. I don't know how long I've been among the spirits. I don't know anything. I'm quite a baby. Never mind, I don't care. I'd rather be a baby. Hello, whoop, hello there." He was checked in his transports by the churches ringing out the lustiest peals he has ever heard. Running to the window, he opened it and put out his head. No fog, no mist. Clear, bright, jovial, stirring cold. Cold piping for the blood to dance to. Golden sunlight, heavenly sky, sweet fresh air, merry bells. Oh, glorious, glorious. "What's today?" cried Scrooge, calling downwards to a boy in Sunday clothes who perhaps had loitered in to look about him. "What's today?"
"Eh?"
"What's today, my fine fellow?"
"Today? Why, Christmas Day."
"It's Christmas Day. I haven't missed it. The spirits have done it all in one night. They can do anything they like. Of course they can. Hello, my fine fellow."
"Hello?"
"Do you know the Peltries in the next street but one at the corner?"
"I should hope I did."
"An intelligent boy. A remarkable boy. Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one."
"What, the one as big as me?"
"What a delightful boy. It's a pleasure to talk to him. Yes, my buck?"
"It's hanging there now."
"Is it? Go and buy it."
"Walker!"
"No, no, I'm in earnest. Go and buy it and tell them to bring it here that I may give them the direction where to take it. Come back with the man and I'll give you a shilling. Come back with him in less than 5 minutes and I'll give you half a crown." The boy was off like a shot. He must have been a steady hand at a trigger who could have got a shot off half as fast. "I'll send it to Bob Cratchit's. He shan't know who sends it. It's twice the size of Tiny Tim. Joe Miller never made such a joke as sending it to Bob's will be." The hand in which he wrote the address was not a steady one, but write it he did somehow, and went downstairs to open the street door ready for the coming of the poulterer's man. "Ah, here's the turkey. Hello, whoop, how are you? Merry Christmas." It was a turkey. He never could have stood upon his legs, that bird. He would have snapped them short off in a minute, like sticks of sealing wax. "Why, it's impossible to carry that to Camden Town," said Scrooge. "You must have a cab." The chuckle with which he said this, and the chuckle with which he paid for the turkey, and the chuckle with which he recompensed the boy, were only to be exceeded by the chuckle with which he sat down breathless in his chair again, and chuckled till he cried. He dressed himself all in his best, and at last got out into the streets. The people were by this time pouring forth as he had seen them with the ghost of Christmas present, and walking with his hands behind him, Scrooge regarded everyone with a delighted smile. He looked so irresistibly pleasant, in a word, that three or four good-humoured fellows said, "Good morning, sir, and Merry Christmas to you." And Scrooge said afterwards that of all the blithe sounds he had ever heard, those were the blithest in his ears. He had not gone far when, coming on towards him, he beheld the portly gentleman who had walked into his counting-house the day before, and said, "Scrooge and Marley's, I believe." It sent a pang across his heart to think how this old gentleman would look upon him when they met. But he knew what path lay straight before him, and he took it. "My dear sir, how do you do? I hope you succeeded yesterday. It was very kind of you. A Merry Christmas to you, sir."
"Mr. Scrooge?"
"Yes. That is my name, and I fear it may not be pleasant to you. Allow me to ask your pardon, and will you have the goodness... Let me whisper in your ear, if you will, sir."
"Lord, bless me. My dear Mr. Scrooge, are you serious?"
If you please, not a farthing less."
"My dear sir, I don't know what to say to such people."
"Not another word. There are a great many back payments in it, I assure you. Come and see me. Will you come and see me?"
"I will."
"Thank you. I am much obliged to you. I thank you 50 times. Bless you." In the afternoon, he turned his steps towards his nephew's house. He passed the door a dozen times before he had the courage to go up and knock. But he made a dash and did it. The maid opened the door. "Nice girl. Very. Is your master at home, my dear?"
"Yes, sir."
"Where is he, my love?"
"He's in the dining room, sir, along with the mistress. I'll show you upstairs, if you please."
"Thank you. He knows me. I'll go in here, my dear." He turned the knob gently and sidled his face in round the door. They were looking at the table, which was spread out in great array, for these young housekeepers are always nervous on such points and like to see that everything is right. "Fred," said Scrooge.
"Why, bless my soul, who's that?"
"It's I. It's your Uncle Scrooge. I've come to dinner. Will you let me in, Fred?" Let him in? It's a mercy he didn't shake his arm off. He was at home in 5 minutes. Nothing could be heartier. His niece looked just the same. So did Topper when he came. So did the plump sister when she came. So did everyone when they came. Wonderful party. Wonderful games. Wonderful unanimity. Wonderful happiness. But he was early at the office next morning. Oh, he was early there. If he only could be there first and catch Bob Cratchit coming late. That was the thing he had set his heart upon. And he did it. Yes, he did. The clock struck 9, no Bob. A quarter past, no Bob. He was full 18 minutes and a half behind his time. Scrooge sat with his door open, that he might see him come into the tank. His hat was off before he opened the door, his comforter too. He was on his stool in a jiffy, driving away with his pen as if he were trying to overtake 9 o'clock. Hello, growled Scrooge in his accustomed voice, as near as he could feign it. What do you mean by coming here at this time of day?
I am very sorry, sir. I am behind my time.
You are? Yes, I think you are. Step this way, sir, if you please.
It's only once a year, sir. It shall not be repeated. I was making rather merry yesterday, sir.
Now, I tell you what, my friend, I'm not going to stand this sort of thing any longer. And therefore, he continued, leaping from his stool and giving Bob such a dig in the waistcoat that he staggered back into the tank again, and therefore I'm about to raise your salary. Bob trembled and got a little nearer to the ruler. He had a momentary idea of knocking Scrooge down with it, holding him and calling to the people in the court for help and a straight waistcoat. A merry Christmas, Bob, said Scrooge, with an earnestness that could not be mistaken as he clapped him on the back. A merrier Christmas, Bob, my good fellow, than I have given you for many a year. I'll raise your salary and endeavour to assist your struggling family, and we'll discuss your affairs this very afternoon over a Christmas bowl of smoking Bishop, Bob. Make up the fires and buy another coal scuttle before you dot another I, Bob Cratchit. Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all and infinitely more. And to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as the good old city knew, or any other good old city, town, or borough in the good old world. Some people laughed to see the alteration in him, but he let them laugh, and little heeded them. For he was wise enough to know that nothing ever happened on this globe for good at which some people didn't have their fill of laughter at the outset. And knowing such as these would be blind anyway, he thought it quite as well that they should wrinkle up their eyes in grins as have the malady in less attractive forms. His own heart laughed, and that was quite enough for him. He had no further intercourse with spirits, but lived upon the total abstinence principle ever afterwards. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
You have been listening to a dramatized version of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. Produced and narrated by Claude Dickens, a great-grandson of the author. Those taking part were Audrey Dickens, Norrie and Penny Martin, Tom and Anne Ridout, Peter Swain, and his two young daughters, Nicola and Gail. The preceding has been recorded from the presentation given originally on Christmas Eve, 1958.